This is Get Lit with Literature, and this is Monk. You can find out more at my website, allbook-books.com. This is part three about Roger Jones's book, Physics as Metaphor. That'll do it for the series, unless after I finish the book, I decide to do a part four. But the book is well covered in this interview with Stephen T. Newcomb, who adds much insight. Well, here's his bio. Stephen T. Newcomb is Shawnee and Lenape. He's the co-founder and director of the Indigenous Law Institute, which he founded with traditional Oglala Lakota headman Virgil Killstraight. Newcomb is also the director of Original Nations Advocates, and he has been studying and writing about U.S. federal Indian law and policy and the doctrine of discovery and domination for some four decades. His work focuses on the contrast between the free existence of our native nations and peoples extending back to the beginning of time and the system of domination that was brought by ship across the Atlantic Ocean and imposed on everyone and everything. There is an additional contrast between the ecological and spiritual wisdom of original nations and peoples and the patterns of domination and dehumanization used for centuries against indigenous nations and peoples on the basis of the Vatican papal documents and royal charters. Newcomb published many of his findings in his book Pagans in the Promised Land, Decoding the Doctrine of Christian Discovery, 2008. And he is co-producer of a documentary movie, The Doctrine of Discovery, Unmasking the Domination Code, directed by Sheldon Wolfchild, who is Dakota, a movie which is based on his book, Pagans in the Promised Land. Now, after I read his book a while ago, and it's fabulous, I recommend it. And the documentary I recently watched, and I thought that if I had seen that kind of thing in high school, that would have changed the trajectory of my life and saved me umpteen years of not knowing one of the most essential bits of history and current affairs. It's too often ignored and overlooked. So Steve's work shines a light on what literally affects all of us in some way or another. And he also enables the perspective of how all this affects the web of life and all sentient beings, and as well the way that we think and speak. And as a writer who tends towards the poetic side of things, I'm fascinated often by what he says, because he presents the legal aspects or legal definitions which shine a whole nother light on the topics. So it's a deep discussion, and for some who are not familiar with it, as I say a couple of times in the interview, you may experience a bit of mind-blowing. So listen carefully and enjoy. Thank you. All right, welcome Stephen T. Newcomb to my little podcast, Get Lit with Literature. I wanted to have you on because a while ago you mentioned this amazing book, Physics as Metaphor by Roger S. Jones, and I started reading it. And it's like you said, it's a wonder that it didn't become more popular. And I thought it would be fun to talk with you. And since you've read the whole book, I'm still working my way through it, just to get your view about it and how it relates to the Native perspective. And I thought of saying, you know, thanks for making time to do this talk. And I thought, well, that's one of the cardinal metaphors that he kind of deconstructs is time. So, welcome, and maybe you could start off talking about the four cardinal metaphors or whatever seems appropriate.
Well, yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to have this conversation about his book, Physics as Metaphor. And I don't even remember how I came across the book. It must have been at a used bookstore. I spent a lot of time in those stores. And in any case, when I started to read it, I've been fascinated by the topic of metaphor for many years, for decades actually. And when I began to delve into what he had written, it surprised me how profound the presentation of the information was, the way in which it helped me to understand the extent to which the fundamental metaphors of space, time, matter, and number are constructions of the human mind. And he defines metaphor as an act of consciousness that borders on the very creation of things. And that, what does that mean? Well, it means that the way in which we name things creates the reality that we experience. And the way in which the naming process operates, we usually don't think of that extending to a concept like space or to a concept like time or the idea of matter, you know, physicality, something that has physical substance as far as our body can feel it or what have you, or numbers for that matter. And then he reveals that those are all constructs of the human mind. And what it gets at, to an extent, is the way in which assumptions work in our everyday lives and the way in which assumptions form the very fabric of reality as we experience it. And so it's a terrific book. I highly recommend it to people. The way in which I see that it informs my work on way in which metaphor operates in federal Indian law and policy is that it traces back to the first naming that the colonizers engaged in. And the reason I bring up naming is that one definition of metaphor, at least as Aristotle defined it, has to do with the applying the name for one thing to something else. And when you apply that name for something else to some other object or person or what have you, you have a metaphorical spark of insight or meaning or whatever. And so a key example is Columbus. When he went to that very first island, the Taino people understood it as being Guanahani, and that was their name for that island. So he went there and he put the name San Salvador on that island. So that was a use of metaphor, applying the name, the Holy Savior, in as expressed in Spanish, meaning Jesus, to that island. And so it's not just the name, but it's the entire system of meaning that's attached to that name as well. So the entire theology of Christianity, the Bible, everything you could think of that entails or that's included in that idea of the Holy Savior and that contextualizes that concept, that's all contained in that one name. And so that whole reality system is then being superimposed on that island and everybody living there. So that's an extraordinary phenomenon where you can take something that's already existing and that another nation or people already have their own intimate relationship with for thousands of years, and then suddenly displace that through a simple process of naming. And that becomes the initial toehold, so to speak, for claiming a right of domination over that area. And the first way in which that domination, or claim of a right of domination, I should say, gets imposed is through that naming process.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, that's a lot like, you know, especially on the East Coast, there's New England, New York, New Jersey. Then there's New Mexico, so
yep.
It's all the names that just overlay. It's like this veneer that, like you're saying, amazingly affects the consciousness, and then I guess how then we relate with time, you know, for example, time and space, because then it kind of imprinted the colonial, what is it, the calendar goes back to the Roman and the clock, and all that stuff was kind of imprinted, right? The whole sense of time and even space.
Absolutely. So when you go to the Vatican Papal Bull from 1452 or the one from 1455, Dum Diversus for 1452 and Romanus Pontifex for 1455, you have the same words being used in both documents: invade, search out, capture, vanquish, subdue. So the way in which that's a methodology, right? And the way in which the mind gets captured is by the use of the names that we're talking about. So it's an extraordinary thing that just by the simple act of superimposing a name on a land or on another people, or it could be heathen, pagan, infidel, barbarous, savage, uncivilized, all those labels are metaphors. They're examples of some type of naming in one context that is then projected onto a different context, and therefore a metaphorical creation is being created, an act of consciousness is being created that borders on the very creation of things. I would say that it does more than borders on the creation of things. It creates a whole system of reality experientially, conceptually, psychologically, emotionally, spiritually. And as an example of that phenomenon, just try to think of time independent of the calendar, of the Gregorian calendar. Well, how do you do that? Now our minds are so hooked into that Gregorian calendar, it's on our phones, it's on the calendars that we put on our walls and so forth. That becomes just completely integrated into the reality system that we've grown up in, and we have no way of escaping that and still being a functional part of the social order, the world order that we understand today. I mean, it's quite amazing which it all works.
It's amazing how much. I have a friend that used to live out in the woods, a native guy used to live out in the woods in the tent, and I would go visit him, and we'd talk, and I remember telling him, oh, by the way, it's a daylight savings time, and he just kind of shrugged his shoulders, and then I realized, oh, yeah, he kind of got up, you know, when the sun rose, and then got inside when the sun went down, so it is a whole different whole paradigm of lifestyle. It is affected by all the things you're saying, and it sounds very simple, but it obviously is. It's like affected hundreds and thousands of years of man, you know, consciousness.
Yeah, and those are techniques that are understood by certain elite or highly intelligent sectors of society around the world, and they're able to use the metaphors of time, space, matter, and number to create a system of control. And so that, which I call the domination system, mm-hmm. or the system of domination. And try going one day without using any concept of time, any concept of matter, or any concept of numbers. You can't do it. It's impossible. And so, isn't that amazing? And then even with geometry, now you say things like, oh, I get your point. Well, point is the concept of geometry, right?
Yeah.
Well, we got to fall in line. Well, that's a concept of geometry. And so geo is earth, and meter is to measure the earth. So these are systems of measurement and presumptions and assumptions and concepts, presuppositions that go to make up the deep structure of what we're calling reality in our everyday lives.
Yeah, that's exactly. I mentioned in the second part of this series about this book, another book I'm reading by Matthias Desmet, The Psychology of Totalitarianism, where he cites a study where they measured the coast of Great Britain, but the whole thing depended on the size of the measurement. So if you were measuring in like 500 meter chunks, it would be, oh, the coast is 2,400 miles. And if you measured in 250 meter chunks, then the size of the coast went up to 300, and, you know, it went up. So it's like, yeah, it's exactly what you're saying. The whole, it's all relative to the choices of the measurements. So it's all kind of illusory.
Well, it's also subjective.
Yeah, that's the word.
And there's debate over objectivity and subjectivity, and whether we have an objective viewpoint, that kind of thing, right? Science, objective findings of science, that kind of thing. Well, Roger Jones makes the very amazing observation that when you get into measurement, you have to determine, first of all, how are you going to use idea of measurement and what system of measurement you're going to use. Mm-hmm. So you could use meters or centimeters or whatever it might be, and it's all based upon certain kinds of presumptions and as to what is actually existing. So he has a wonderful chapter on that. And now here's how it really is pretty interesting in terms of federal Indian law and these pronouncements by the U.S. Supreme Court having to do with some kind of idea of measurement, because you have the original free and independent existence of our nations and peoples, and as I always say, extending back to the beginning of time through our oral histories and traditions. And then you have the system of domination brought by ship across the ocean and imposed on everyone and everything. Well, with a kind of a nod to that understanding, Chief Justice John Marshall says of the Native Nations, their rights to complete sovereignty as independent nations, well, that's the original free and independent existence, were necessarily diminished. In other words, their rights were necessarily diminished. Why necessarily? Because it was necessary to the system they were creating, conceptually, right, mm-hmm. through the ideas and argumentation. And by, what was it diminished by? The original fundamental principle that discovery gave title to those who made it. Now, when he says necessarily diminished, you have the 100% free and independent existence, the full capacity or the full height or however you want to think about that, being somehow reduced to a lower height or to a lower level, or reduced in terms of its extent or volume. Okay, but here's the thing. How did he determine to what extent it had been diminished? He says it was diminished, but how did he determine that? And what it turns out is that it's just him spinning yarns. He's creating stories. He's engaging in a form of storytelling that's necessary to the enterprise that they're embarking upon in order to remove or eliminate or destroy or explain away the original free existence of Native nations and peoples, and put their own free and independent existence in the place of the original nations. So he's saying, as a result of that, we have to think of their original independence as being diminished, made lesser in extent or reduced down, which coincides with the language in the Vatican Papal Bull, ac barbari nationis deprimantur, for barbarous nations to be reduced. There's that word of math, reduction, mm-hmm. a word of subtraction. And so the subtraction is make lesser than the original amount.
Yeah.
So how it's occurring because they're using the human mind and ideas on paper to create these imaginings that make it seem as if those things have happened. And once that has been accepted over a long enough period of time, that becomes cemented into a form of reality.
Hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating, because as you were talking about, when you're saying the word diminished, because of the context of what we're talking about, I was thinking, wow, that's numerical. And then when you said reduced, that's obviously numerical. So that's just like a mind-blowing connection of all that stuff.
One thing that I'd like to add is that it occurs to me that the Supreme Court in the Johnson versus McIntosh ruling and other rulings, the Supreme Court is using space, time, matter, and number, those four cardinal metaphors that Roger Jones mentions in his book, as a means of establishing and maintaining control over Native nations. And that's a really profound insight when you think about it.
That is. That'll be definitely something to think about. And again, how that whole, the whole structure of the Jones book, how it's like applied to all that stuff is, again, it's kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole, when you think about it, warfare is premised upon using space, time, matter, and number for purposes of control. You know, you have to keep track of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to be able to move your troops through space. And you have to use numbers. You're not going to be able to make your calculations without the numbers, and then you're going to use material objects and the matter to construct all your munitions and transport vehicles and you name it, whatever you need in the way of supplies are all part of the use of matter. So isn't that something? It's just wow.
It is. It's like the whole system. Like I always think about the mechanization where they can track, you know, you get the order a package and hey, it's nice to know when the package is going to come home, you know, going to get home and track it and all. But then when I think about that with some country or some place that's dealing with, you know, they don't have water or there was just a disaster or something. And it's like, well, what about getting them some help as quick as they just tracked everything?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like the whole metaphor structure is like you talk about the system of domination. It's like it rules the system at the lack of other stuff. I know some people they're not familiar with your work. You explain a lot of some of the references you're making in your wonderful book, Pagans in the Promised Land, and then your documentary film, which I'm trying to remember the name, but I'll let you say it.
The Doctrine of Discovery, Unmasking the Domination Code, directed by Sheldon Wolfram.
Yeah, that's an excellent, powerful film. You know, the book and the film I recommend to people. And, yeah, that's an amazing connection with the number factor. Now, because that's one of the quotes I wanted to pose, but you pretty much answered it when Jones writes, number is an interrelated aspect of the divide and conquer metaphor, which extends and diversifies the primal unity. So that seems to connect with some of exactly what you're talking about, except, you know, not conquer, because Native peoples haven't been conquered. Obviously, there's been a lot of troubles, but not conquered.
Well, I mean, this is where you get into the fascinating nuance of language. So the word conquer, divide and conquer, well, let me back up for a second.
All right.
When we have an understanding of our original free existence, and the system of domination brought by ship across the ocean, we also have then a view from the shoreline, mm-hmm. looking out at the ships coming in, the colonizing ships invading and coming to shore. We also have the perspective from the ship coming toward shore. When we look at the phrase divide and conquer from the viewpoint of the ship, the accurate translation for that is divide and win. Divide and win, because conquer is the sense of winning, defeating an enemy, and becoming victorious. So you have also the sense of victory. From the shore, looking out at the ship, it's divide and dominate, because it's a negative thing coming in. It's not the people on the receiving end of domination don't want to think of the people doing that to them as being victorious over them. Or having won, they want to at least think, hey, we're still in this fight, even if it's been centuries. And so that's part of the challenge, is that the language is immediately pretty much interpreted from the viewpoint of the ship, not from the people on shore. And so we have to take that into account in terms of what Roger Jones is explaining in that part of his book.
Yeah, when you said win, too, when you talked about the, you know, the colonists and the kind of wins, you know, win psychology, again, I'm thinking about now in numerically, because win, typically I think of, you know, points and sports, and if it's war, then it's like who has less, you know, more casualties, less casualties, whose weaponry has, you know, it's a numerical scorekeeping that becomes the dominant thing, rather than, you know, how can we share, like that saying, feeding two birds with one seed, how can we share the stuff? Instead, it becomes numerically, it's like a battleground.
Well, and even that use of language, to kill two birds with one stone, that's that whole domination mentality toward the birds is part and parcel of the whole mm-hmm. way of thinking, expressing oneself, and so forth. And yeah, it's just the most extraordinary thing you're saying. And then also when you think about the points, we're back to that word point again, right? The points in winning a game, the one with the most points wins. And so the concept of point in geometry, once again, we're back to that idea. Isn't that something?
It's amazing. And yeah, I think I actually heard, maybe I heard Tom Porter, the Mohawk chief, I think he even said that feed two birds with one seed is the original. So I don't know. That's my memory of it. Maybe that come, you know, like a native perspective, it makes sense to me. That would be the original phrase that got twisted. I don't know if you...
Well, certainly the view, it could be a view from the shore.
Right.
From the perspective of one of the original one of the original languages, but also the original nations of the continent. And remember what I quoted from Johnson versus McIntosh, and what the Chief Justice Marshall was saying, the original and fundamental principle that discovery gave title. Well, they're claiming the word original and fundamental for them, not for the original nations. That's why I began to use original nations as a way of contradicting, challenging Marshall's use of language in that sentence.
Yeah, there's a lot of, obviously you've studied this stuff for many years, so there's a depth to it, and you know, all the nuances there are quite amazing. I want to quote one little, just to give a flavor of Jones's book, because it's the kind of book where I sometimes just literally have to stop. I read a few lines and I stop. And there's one where it's in chapter called Time for Change. He said, causality is thus a metaphor-linked notion. It can exist only relative to a specific view of space and time. Causality depends on the notion of an extended space-time, one possessing distance, interval, and measure. So I'd have to think about that to even get what he's talking about. But just the idea that the whole cause and effect thing, that in itself is based on, again, these metaphors, which are, you know, flimsy.
Well,
is what it sounds like.
They're flimsy.
But I mean,
yeah, I mean, but here.
What I mean, flimsy, right. I mean, it's like there's a relative, they're not like foolproof. You can deconstruct them a bit.
Well, metaphor is not able to prove anything.
Right, okay.
A metaphor is an assertion.
Right.
It's an assumption of truth without proof.
Right.
And no proof is needed because it's already demonstrated through its use that it's obviously true. So therefore, we don't have to even delve into it. And that they would love nothing more than to have Native nations and peoples act like that toward their mental constructions. The key point is that they've fabricated it all. The reality that we're living in these days is a complete mental fabrication by the invaders, by the colonizers. And my particular task, as just one approach to it, is to reveal it as being a mental construct. And it might be very deadly in many ways in terms of how it treats others and goes after their resources and all that. But nonetheless, they're using the concepts of space, time, matter, and number as a weapon system against original native peoples. And so one of the ways in which that works in terms of space, and Marshall, I mean, if we delved into it, we could find language in the Johnson versus McIntosh ruling from 1823 where Marshall is talking about these things. And you cannot have two things in the exact same space simultaneously. So he says, well, absolute title is absolute. It's also exclusive. Now, these are all metaphors that he's using, right? Well, if it's exclusive, it means it excludes all others. He points that out. And if it's absolute, it doesn't cave into anything because it's absolute. So there's nothing that can go up against it. And the space cannot have two free and independent nations existing in the same space. So what does he do? Well, he has to negate or cancel out the original nations. And the way in which he does that is through a mental process of negation, just saying, well, they don't exist. The original free existence has gone away because we say it has, and therefore they are what we claim they are, and we're the ones that determine reality. And how do we know that? Because he uses a sentence at the outset of the ruling where he says the character and religion of the continent's inhabitants afforded an apology, which means created an excuse, for considering them as a people over whom the superior genius of Europe might claim an ascendancy. And what is an ascendancy? Controlling influence, governing power, domination. It's one of the few words in the English language that has domination right in the definition. So he's saying the original free existence and also the nations themselves are null and void. And they, at least the, in terms of being able to challenge the claim of a right of domination of the incoming system. And so since it's null and void, there's nothing that can contradict the claim of a right of domination, which he terms ultimate dominion. And dominion goes to, if you take the letter N from the end of dominion, you get dominio, which is the Latin word for to dominate. And that also goes to domo, to subjugate, to subdue, to force into subservience, to tame, to domesticate, to cultivate, and to till. And also goes to dominium, which William Brandon in 1987, he went through the whole idea of dominion and dominium. And then he said, political power grown from property, dominium, in with hyphens between it, was in effect domination. So political power grown from property, well, property is another form of domination because Ballantyne's Law Dictionary from 1969 says that that property means not the material object itself, but the right of domination rightfully obtained over such object. So political power grown from domination was in effect, dominium was in effect domination. Let me repeat that one more time. Political power grown from property, in other words, political power grown from domination, dominium was in effect domination. And the reason it that way is because so much of this language is actually repeating domination, 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 domination over and over again, but no one notices it because instead of the word domination, they use synonyms and euphemisms for domination, which hides and cloaks the fact that that's what's going on.
Wow. Yeah. That part of the reason I enjoy talking with you, Steve, is because this stuff, I have to pause and go, okay, let me see if I can say back something what you said, because that's a real eye-opener. Because, you know, coming from the legal angle, you said something about the property, is it that the laws about property then become like what rules things, but it's not, you're not actually talking about the property itself, something like that? It's like there's all these laws about property, but it's about the law that people discuss and not like the actual land?
Well, no, you have, it's important to understand that the word property is not referring to the physical object. It's referring to the right of domination over or in relation to the physical object.
Okay.
So the law is made of language.
Right. Okay. That's
and the language is made of linguistic techniques of domination. And once you understand that, then every time you hear the law, the complete phrase is the law of domination. Every time you hear the phrase the system, well, you know, this and that about the system, the complete phrase is the system of domination. Whenever you hear the phrase state, the complete phrase is the state of domination. But they don't want people to understand any of this. So we're all taught to speak in partialities, and the partialities drop any acknowledgement of the fact that it is a system of domination, and that the language is designed to speak around that and avoid focusing on that fact. And people that I know of that has ever figured out, oh, wow, it's all domination, like the zeros and ones of the binary code that gives us the internet, that coding process, well, with this, it's just domination, 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 domination over and over again. And so then that's the end result. But who the heck knows that?
Wow. Yeah, so, wow, I know. So, let's see, what can I say after all that? Except, talking about it obviously raises, to me personally, it raises the awareness, so then I can somehow, you know, in my mind, I think, okay, now I can think through some of these things better. I mean, is there any, is obviously, the just, you know, talking about it helps people be more aware of it so they can maybe, you know, unravel their minds or whatever, the way they're living, or some way to kind of disentangle from this, but then the system's still there, so to speak. I don't know if you know what I'm trying to get at. Like,
yeah, the complete way of phrasing that question, but the system of domination is still there.
Right.
So when you put domination on the end of that, now you're getting at truly naming what it is that we're dealing with. So the word government, think of how many people you know that when they're talking about the government, they'd say things like our government.
Mm-hmm.
Now, would they ever say our domination?
Nope.
If they understand that the system of government is actually a system of domination, then would they say, oh yeah, our domination? Well, you know, when the domination raised our taxes, or when they changed the tax code, or when they came out with that crime bill, when the system of domination came out with that crime bill, but it's, they don't say system of government, they generally say the government. So if they were saying the domination instead of the government, would get at the truth of the matter, now people would become hyper-conscious of what's actually going on. I see things where people write and they say, well, our civilization is on the verge of collapse.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they ever say our domination is on the verge of collapse? They did. The contradiction would be immediate, would be immediately evident, because they, well, who gives a shit if the system of domination is on the verge of collapse? Maybe it needs to collapse, because we shouldn't be living under and sub to a system of domination to begin with.
Yeah, it sounds like people can at least start, you know, like you're doing, is focusing the language, you know, having people speak more accurately is one way to shift the conversations.
Yeah, exactly right. And by doing that, then together we become cognizant of that which is generally unnoticed. There's that which is easily noticed, and those things that remain unnoticed. And the things that remain unnoticed include the extent to which the entire system of domination has been constructed on the basis of a claim of a right of domination. So a claim of a right of domination, that initial toehold when they come and do the ceremony on the shore and claim everything for themselves, what they're really doing is claiming that they have a right of domination, God-given or Bible-given or however they might have come upon it or have been given that right, so they claim, and that everyone is now subject to their claim of a right of domination. But no history book says that. No civics book says that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no high school book on the world civilization says that. We're taught to believe that civilization is a positive, you know. And so when you realize that, if from the view from the shore, the definition of civilization is the forcing of a cultural pattern on another nation or people, well, that's a process of domination. So then why would we view, as people from the shore looking out at the ship, why would we view that process of domination as something positive, as a positive good? It would make no sense to do that.
Yeah, you totally makes sense. What you're saying, that makes no sense. The other thing too, I think, like when you talk about the language, it, one thing that's helped me even now when I read news or I listen to whatever talking heads on the TV or whatever, is the things that you're saying, I think can help also to see through, or to, you know, hear through what they're saying, to then, you know, not believe everything, just to swallow it all, like, oh yeah, well, that's an authority figure. But if you listen more carefully, it can help to realize who's kind of trying to pull the wool over our eyes.
Well, I think etymology is an excellent cure for gullibility.
That's a good one. I like that.
Because you start looking into the origin of words, who knew that dominion, that the root of dominion is dominio, which is the Latin word for to dominate. Mm-hmm. Dominion sounds almost kind of benign. It's just some noun. It's just something. Yeah, okay, dominion. But in the scourge, if you know what a whip called the scourge, mm-hmm. the many lashes on there with little metal barbs at the end of those, at the end of each lash, that was called a scourge, and that was considered to be the symbol of dominion during the Roman Empire. So how horrific is that? So what's happened, there's a deadening effect over time where if we're not the ones being beaten with one of those type of whips, or we don't know people that are being beat and abused and tormented in that way, then it's less likely to have any real effect on our consciousness in terms of how we understand those ideas, you know.
Yeah, I think like from the non-native perspective, it's like the way that's affected the non-natives is to kind of make them feel good, like, oh, now you're the, you know, now you're the property owner. It's like, whoa, that, you know, makes somebody feel good. Like the euphemisms and the way the phrasing is has been twisted to even, you know, make people feel proud of that, which is a long way from, you know, from the opposite, from what you're saying.
Well, if we said, well, they're the domination owner.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? We switched property to the word domination and said, oh, yeah, he's the domination owner for this area right here. You know, oh, I got to get to, oh my God, I didn't mail in my death grip this month. You know, the death grip, which is a mortgage.
Okay,
mortgage,
right, yep.
Death grip.
Oh my God.
I forgot to mail in my death grip payment this month.
Jeez.
If we spoke in a way that acknowledged the real nature of how the system of domination operates, we would suddenly be in a whole different type of awareness. And with that shared awareness, we would suddenly awaken to a dimension that we're oblivious to in our everyday lives.
Well, that's a wonderful way to say it, because that's part of what the fascination for me with Jones's book and what is that way he's describing space and time and number and metaphor. It makes me realize, wait, it makes me look at thing or experience, whatever the words are, the other dimensions, because he shows the limitations of those, you know, the way it's been structured.
So yeah. So
that's what I appreciate, you know, what you're saying and tying it in with his book. So.
Oh yeah, it's so extraordinary when you really come to that deep insight about the relationship between reality and naming, the reality that we experience in our everyday lives and the naming process, the words that we use. It's pretty intense.
Mm-hmm.
Because and also from another viewpoint, because once Columbus had successfully imposed San Salvador on that island that the native people called Guanahani, try separating that name from the island afterwards. Well, you can't do it because it becomes embedded in the consciousness of all the people, the non-native people living there, and maybe even in the minds of the native people as well. And pretty soon, it's impossible to separate the land from that name.
All right, yeah, I guess that might get into some of the legal battles, right, with the lands and the name. Does that come up?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
So take the Kumeyaay Nation territory, now commonly called San Diego. We'll try taking the name San Diego off of the Kumeyaay Nation territory. How could you do it? It's like the escape in the calendar. It's insinuated into so many aspects of our lives, and we're tied into that calendar to such an extent that it's impossible to escape it. And what do we do with that? Well, that's a real question. That's a real challenge as far as what do we do about it. But the first thing to do about it is to become aware of the fact that it exists.
All right, Steve. Yeah, and thanks so much for all this. It could go on and on, but I think that's a lot just right there for people to hear and start to digest.
Oh, sure.
Anything else you want to add to kind of, or no, see, I'm watching my language now. I'm talking numerically. Anything else you want to say include?
When you say we could go on and on, that's what people say about me. The guy goes on and on.
Well, I say it in a good way. It's fascinating. not in a, oh my God, he goes on and on. That's a different.
Yeah.
Different way, but anything to see now. I'm rethinking how I'm speaking.
I love your book, and I just I think you're doing a great job, and I appreciate it. And you know, you're one of the few people that actually followed up on my advice about reading Roger Jones' book, and you got deep into it. And I sometimes feel like it's when I get deep into that book, it's almost an out-of-body experience. It sends me into another form of consciousness. It's really something else. That's how Stephen Winter's book, Clearing in the Forest, Law, Life, and Mind, mm-hmm. which became very instrumental in my book, Pagans in the Promised Land. But, it's all such a wonderful process of inquiry and examination and revelation, to use a funny word, but the insights and understandings. And when we're able to share those insights and understandings in conversations like this, it's pretty wonderful. So I appreciate it.
You're welcome. I think another woman, a friend I'm working with, she was she comes from a science background, and she taught geology, and she ordered the book. I don't know if she got it yet. So, you know, it's mentioning, that's why I like just talking and mentioning this and that, because who knows who might pick up on it. So how do people, what's your website? Original Free Nations, is that it?
Yeah, you can go to originalfreenations.com, indigenouslawinstitute.com. We'll be working on an additional website here shortly. And I really appreciate you interviewing me, and anybody that would like to reach out could do so at info@originalfreenations.com.
All right. Thanks again, Steve. And appreciate it. And much to ponder. And I still got to work my way through this book. Like I said, it's the kind of book for me that I got to read a little bits at a time, because there's so much in it. And the physics part of it is a bit above my head. But I think different people would get different things from this book. And your books as well. Definitely worth a read, The Pagans in the Promised Land.
Yeah, terrific. Well, you take care.
All right. Thanks so much, Steve.